Let me ask you honestly, what do you think of when you hear the term drug addicts? What do you think or you feel when you hear about drug addicts overdosing? What do you think of or feel when you hear about a drug addict dying from an overdose? Today, we're continuing our series, My Neighbor Wants to Know, and this is a series where people from the congregation have submitted questions to me that either their neighbors have asked them in the past, or maybe they're worried their neighbors might ask them, and that might be preventing them from talking to their neighbors about Jesus. And so this is a series designed to not only answer your questions, but to equip you to answer the questions of others. So I want you to keep in mind, you may learn a lot this morning, I hope you do. I hope, though, that you don't just take it in as something you're learning, but you can also think about how you can talk about this at work, over lunch, with a neighbor, and kind of be equipped to share with others about what a Christian response should be to the questions that we're asking. And to be honest, this is because these were questions submitted to me, this is a topic I never, ever would have preached on. This is not in my wheelhouse. This is not a kind of thing that I'm involved in. And, you know, to be honest, the first question I actually had to ask when this question was submitted to me, and one of the reasons why I pushed it later in the series was I had to ask myself, is the opioid crisis really a crisis? Right? Just, you know, you hear about something on the news a bunch, it doesn't always mean that it's a crisis. Well, one of the things I've learned is actually, yes, this really is a crisis to a degree that I was unaware of. And so, in the States, our neighbors to the South, as Canadians, we, to be honest, we look down our noses at them about their gun violence and gun laws and being gun crazy. And full disclosure, I'm an American citizen. I wasn't born there, but I was raised there. And my parents and my family are all there. So anyway, you know, we think about gun violence in the States as being this horrendous thing. And maybe you've heard on the news about, like, you know, the gun violence in Chicago over the past couple summers. Did you know that last year in the U.S., more people died from opioid-related overdoses than gun violence? And we talk a lot about traffic accidents and car accidents and drunk driving and all of that. More people in the States last year died from opioid overdose accidents than died from car accidents. I had no idea that this was so prevalent. To be honest, I had no idea so many people were using opioid-related drugs. And to be honest, I don't know that many of these overdoses are from people appropriately using prescription pills, but the problem is sometimes when you're supposed to be done the prescription pills and you don't want to be done, that is sometimes a problem. But there are other problems as well that we'll talk about. In Canada, we tend to sometimes hear U.S. statistics and think, well, you know, it's not like that in Canada. In 2018, so from January 1st to December 31st of last year, in Canada, there were 4,460 deaths related to opioid overdoses. And that works out, for scale, one death every 2 hours, every day, day and night, every day of the year, 365 days of the year. So kind of in the time between, you know, when you left for church and by the time you get home today, statistically, somebody in Canada will have died of an overdose related to opium-related products. I had no clue. So in 3 years in Canada, 11,500 people have died. That's a lot of people. Now, why is this happening, right? What's going on? Well, there are a number of contributing factors. I'm not going to even pretend that I understand all of what's going on with it. We actually have some medical professionals in our congregation whose, you know, history is in with, like, mental health and writing policy stuff, so I feel kind of way out of my league talking about this. But I'll give you a thumbnail sketch because this opened my eyes. Maybe you've heard the word fentanyl. Fentanyl is made in a lab. It's a medical prescription drug. It is a synthetic version of an opioid or an opium product. Opium products, morphine is an opium product, as is heroin. These are used for pain management. We were just talking about Gabriel, who is in hospital with rods and plates and all of this. I am sure. Actually, I know. I was chatting with him. I went to visit him. He actually said the doctors told him they were giving him fentanyl, and he kind of freaked out. He's like, wait, wait, isn't that the drug that everybody's dying on? They're like, don't worry. You're in a hospital. We know what we're doing. So fentanyl and opium-related products are actually really helpful for pain management when used well. But what's happening is that drug dealers are taking fentanyl or other, you know, non-stuff they've made up in a lab. They're taking fentanyl and its analogs. And they mix it with more expensive drugs like heroin or morphine because it makes the drugs they're selling more powerful and the fentanyl is really cheap. So it's kind of like giving a fuel injection to the drugs that they're selling. And it's cheap. And so it makes the drugs more powerful. But it's really difficult to control how powerful the fentanyl is that they're making. And different people react to it differently. And so when people get the boosted drugs, they're often overdosing and dying. And it's happening at an alarming rate. And it's not even just that if you accidentally take drugs that had fentanyl mixed in it, but if your drugs were prepared on a table that previously had fentanyl on it and a couple of grains of fentanyl the size of a couple of grains of salt are still on the table and get mixed in with what you take, it can kill you. This is why all of the sudden, all of these people, some of whom probably don't even aren't even trying to take opium-related drugs, are overdosing on fentanyl that got contaminated into something else they're taking. So this is not kind of an area of Canadian life that I interact with very often. So I learned a lot. But it highlights for me, one, how big the crisis is, but two, how big the drug problem is in Canada. If this many people are dying, how many more people are using drugs? So that's why this is happening. So what? What are we supposed to do? To be honest, I was challenged by this sermon and convicted in my preparation. And let me be honest about my conviction is my first response was really hard-hearted. Well, you use drugs and bad things happen. These are the natural foreseeable consequences of becoming a drug user. My brother-in-law is a police officer in Toronto, and he's not a believer, but he actually said, like, he isn't planning on carrying one of those needles that helps people in an overdose situation, because one, he said the paramedics know how to use it better, he doesn't want to be liable, but he also said, look, drug users are doing stupid things, and if you want to inject that stuff in your body, you know the risks. And to be honest, that was often my response. And I've been really convicted over the past couple weeks working on this sermon that that's a horrible response from a Christian. And so I don't know what your response is. I don't know what you feel about drug use. But I will say that I was convicted that each of these people is a human being created in Christ's image. And if we're serious about agape love, this means I need to be deeply concerned with their well-being. And yes, using drugs is foolish and illegal, but that doesn't change the fact that if we need to treat people who struggle with drug use with compassion and with care, and it should break our hearts that people are dying regardless of how they die. So I have been convicted, and I hope the Spirit will convict you if you are in a similar boat as me with this hardness of heart. It also, as I was working on this, I started to think about the fact we have a number of people in our church who are in recovery for substance abuse. We have people in our church who have family members who are either in recovery or maybe even still using. And any one of them could have easily become one of these numbers and one of these statistics dying. If you think about it, the opioid crisis has been in the news for 3 years. So somebody who's been clean for 18 months was still using in the first 18 months of the crisis. So it's been around for a while. So my initial callous response to the opioid crisis really deeply disappoints me. I am disappointed in myself for my callous response to the opioid crisis. I'm disappointed in myself for having a hard-hearted response to people in crisis dying. The other night, Amy and I were watching a show on Netflix, and one of the characters had a really tortured childhood. And he had a very angry, abusive father, and he's broken off a relationship with the family. He comes back and forth sometimes, and Now as an adult in his 40s, he's a train wreck of a human being, and he uses all sorts of substances to try and cope with the pain of his broken relationship with his family and some of the pain of broken parts of his body from his dad's abuse. And in one scene, he's high and he's drunk and he runs into a group of strangers that he joins up with, and he's sitting outside with them and they're smoking drugs, and he's just thinking about the abuse situations of his childhood as he's smoking up, just trying to escape that pain. He's an outcast, he's alienated from his family, he's homeless, he's jobless, he's hanging around with other people who are in a similar boat, all of whom are indulging their addictions together, trying to numb the pain of life. And it got me thinking, has drug addiction become the leprosy of our day? Has drug addiction become the leprosy of our day? What do I mean by that? In the Bible, in biblical times, including in Jesus' time, leprosy was a family of skin diseases that caused a person to become an outcast. It made you spiritually unclean, which meant you couldn't be near people, you couldn't be touched. Lepers had to leave their home. They had to live in isolation outside of the town or outside of the city. Their only companions were other lepers. No good people would ever come near them. Similarly, their families might leave them food at times, but wouldn't come in contact with them. And when lepers were out and about, they had to ring a bell and shout loudly, unclean, unclean, if they ever came near people, so that people would have time to get out of the way, so they wouldn't come in contact with the lepers. And religious leaders of the day, particularly Pharisees, took great pride in the fact that they never came near a leper. And one rabbi actually wrote proudly that he would throw stones at lepers to make sure they didn't get too close to him and make him ceremonially unclean. Which is why it is so shocking that when Jesus is confronted by a leper who runs towards Jesus, Jesus, not only does he not run away, he reaches out and touches the leper. He's been touched since he was diagnosed who knows how many years before. And the saddest part is, in biblical times, many people assumed the reason the person had contracted leprosy, it was their own fault because of some sin in their life. So have we turned drug addiction into the leprosy of our day? They're outcasts, they only hang out with other people like them, they're homeless, they are broken relationships with their family, people run away from them, nobody touches them, and yet Jesus' response to those people is to walk up and touch them and show them love. So what then do we do about the opioid crisis? That's a question that was asked. I struggled with who is we, right? Are you talking about nationally? Are you talking about government? Are you talking about institutionally? Congregationally or individually? I am not a policy expert. I am not going to get political in my sermons. I am not going to wax eloquently about what the government should do at any level to address this problem. I don't know. And I'm not qualified to comment on that anyway. Congregation is in a position to do in terms of any sort of a formal program or anything like that. Rather, I want to focus on the question for each of us as an individual Christian. How do we as Christians respond to the fact that thousands upon thousands of people are dying each year because of drug use? How do we respond to that as individuals? So my neighbor wants to know how we, and I'll insert in there, how should we as Christians, or how, if your neighbor isn't a believer, how are you as Christians responding to the opioid crisis? Again, like most of these questions, the Bible doesn't specifically say, when encountering people who are struggling with drug addiction, do the following, right? The Bible doesn't talk about it directly, but it gives us some very good principles from which we can come to conclusions. And so Jesus doesn't speak about drug use specifically, or even really addiction or drunkenness, but let's consider what he says to broken people. And then similarly, Paul doesn't speak to drug use. He speaks, you know, don't get drunk on wine, but that's a pretty minor part of Paul's teaching, but let's see what he says about responding to people who are not living out the way they should. And so the first passage we're going to look at is a famous one from Matthew chapter 11. So if you would like a Bible and you don't have one, raise your hand nice and high. Our usher will get a Bible to you. Make sure he can see you from the back. Our text in Matthew is found on page 689. Page 689, we're going to read just verses 28 to 30. And then in a moment, we'll turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, page 837 in the church Bibles. So, Matthew chapter 11, 28 to 30, Jesus is talking to the crowds. He says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." And then turn with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14. These are Paul's final instructions to the Thessalonian Christians. So some of them are actual individual statements that you really can take in isolation. Usually we don't do that here, but at the end of his letters, that's appropriate. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14, Paul says, "And we urge you, brothers, warn those who are idle, encourage the timid, help the weak, be patient with everyone." So what is our text saying? What is Jesus saying in Matthew 11? How are we to understand his words? This passage from Matthew 11 is famous. These are precious words of Jesus. You know, "Take my yoke upon you, my burden is easy," or "My yoke is easy, my burden is light." And the passage opens with this invitation: "Come to me, all who are weary." It's an invitation of approach. Notice, actually, in the text, it's significant. Jesus says, "Come to me." Come to him for rest, when in the Old Testament, the one who provides rest is God. There's a subtle statement in here. Jesus doesn't say, "Come to God who will provide you rest." He says, "Come to me and I will provide you rest." There is a subtle to us, but loud and glaring to his original audience, invitation that not only are you to come to God, but that in Jesus you find God. That Jesus is God. So there's a divine reference, you know, a reference to Jesus' own divinity here. He says, "Take my yoke upon you." The background in our PowerPoint today is a yoke, so you can understand what it looks like. We don't live in an agricultural culture, so we don't always know what these references are. You can see the yoke has the bar that goes across, and the two loops go around the neck of two animals. So there's a pairing that happens here. And you know, some commentators were not sure if the idea is that Jesus is in one side and you're in the other and you are yoked equally with him, that he is teaching you how to bear the load, or just the idea that this is his yoke and he's at the back telling you where to go. We're not sure. But regardless, the idea is that you are yoked with Jesus' yoke. A yoke is a tool used to attach animals to a plow or a wagon so that they can pull it together. So Jesus offers equipment for life's burdens, not escape from life's burdens. When you're pulling a burden with a yoke, you are more effective at pulling it. This is better than just a harness or just strapping it to your neck. The yoke helps share the load and is more effective. So to the weary and to the heavy laden, Jesus offers a new way to carry life. The yoke is a work instrument. He does not say, "Come, I have a nice mattress, you can have a nap and find rest." He offers not only refreshment, a little break, life-giving rest, but also he offers equipment for carrying on in life with all of life's burdens. In fact, the most restful gift that he can offer is a new way of life in close relationship with God, the burdens of which are different and lesser than trying to carry on by yourself. A yoke was not just a farm implement, though. We immediately think of the yoke and the oxen and this transportation system. But by Jesus' day, the term yoke had also come to refer to a rabbi's specific teaching or interpretation of the law of Moses. So the yoke of a rabbi was his particular set of teaching, his particular way of life, his particular way of living under the law. And that was his style. Today you might think about it as like kind of like denominational differences, sort of, is like, you know, this is the Baptist yoke, this is the Presbyterian yoke, this is Catholic. Maybe that might be helpful for you, but it's kind of the set of interpretations of the law and how to live under the law and how to live out righteousness with God. And so the set of doctrines specific to a rabbi were that rabbi's yoke. So Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you." Jesus says his interpretation and application of God's law is easy and light to carry. So it's not just a metaphor about live life with me. He's actually saying my understanding of how to get right with God is very different from that of the other teachers that you're familiar with. Now, Jesus' yoke may not be easy to live up to. This is the book of Matthew, which begins with the Sermon on the Mount. That is hard teaching to live up to. They're very difficult commands to live, but compared to the legalistic, burdensome, perfectionistic interpretation of the Pharisees in Jesus' day, Jesus' interpretation is actually incredible. If you push further, the purpose of the law in the Old Testament is to put God's people in a right relationship with him. So what is Jesus' specific teaching on how to be right with God? If that's the purpose of the law, is to justify us, to put us in a right relationship with God, Jesus' understanding, his interpretation, his application of how do you get right with God is much lighter and easier than that of the Old Testament, because Jesus takes our sin upon himself. Our greatest burden, the burden of sin, Jesus takes on his shoulders on the cross in order to reconcile us to God through faith. We can't carry out God's law. Jesus did on our behalf. And so again, Jesus takes the burden, the load, the weight of how do I get right with God, which the Old Testament was the law, the yoke of how you do that. Jesus comes along and he says, yeah, you guys have had a good 1,000 years of this and you haven't been very successful. Take my yoke upon you, because I'm going to take that burden on myself on the cross. And the yoke that I offer, the way that I offer you to get right with God, is much lighter and easier than following all of the Old Testament law. And it's open to all, because I don't know any of us who have a Jewish background. We are not the biological descendants of Abraham, but we are the spiritual descendants of Abraham because of this invitation. So, this is the idea of take my yoke upon you. In Jesus, we find rest, new life, and a new way of life with God. He brings rest to the weary, rest to our souls, a new avenue to righteousness, to being in a right relationship with God. But to do that, we have to take Jesus' yoke upon ourselves. Jesus does not offer us freedom to do what you want. I'm going to forgive your sins so you can go live the way you want to live. He offers us freedom from sin and its consequences. He doesn't offer us escape. Rather, instead of offering us escape, he offers us radically different equipment to live life. He doesn't offer us autonomy, which is self-direction. He offers us a new commander, a new master with a new law. A yoke also is for walking, not for sitting. Right? A yoke, we are to walk with Jesus, to live obediently to him in service. This is not about making a one-time decision or saying one prayer. It's about continually walking in step with Jesus, following his lead. His invitation is free and open to all. Come unto me, all who are weary. But his invitation, while free, comes with consequences. We must take his yoke upon us. Elsewhere, he describes it as we must daily take up our cross and follow him. It is not a free call to freedom, to self-direction, or freedom of self. It is a free call to freedom in Christ. The second half, the need to take Jesus' yoke upon ourselves, this is why so many people do not run to Jesus. They like the idea of being freed from the consequence of their sin. They don't like the idea of then having to live under the yoke of Jesus. They want to be autonomous, even though it is under the yoke of Jesus that we do find new life, deep rest and restoration, and a way to live life to the fullest. So this is what Jesus is saying about take my yoke upon you. Now let's consider what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians. Paul's words, I think, are at least one way of how the church, as Christ's body and ambassadors, can live out Jesus' invitation to the weary. So Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy burdened. I think this verse is actually how the church then lives that out as Christ's representatives. Jesus' words to the weary, his offering of a yoke, his light yoke, must be mirrored in the church, the body who bears his name. If Jesus says his yoke is easy and his burden is light, but the church offers a heavy burden and a difficult yoke, then we are not being the community of Christ. We are not being little Christs, which is what the word Christian means. So let's take a closer look. Paul is writing to all Christians in his final instructions to the Thessalonians. And he says, warn the idle, encourage the timid, and help the weak. The idle, the timid, and the weak all appear to not be following through on their responsibilities. They are not living out carrying their cross. They are not wearing Jesus' yoke. So they have happily accepted the forgiveness of their sins. They're not happy with the lordship of Jesus in their life. They're not living that out. And so from the outside, all three of these kinds or groups of people, the idle, the timid, and the weak, they all look similar. They're not following through on their Christian commitment. Now, who are the idle? The idle are those who are shirking their work, shirking their responsibility. This is the military term for soldiers who can't keep in rank or can't keep in step as they march. They're falling out all over the place. They're out of line, literally. The second group, the timid, these are the people who lack courage naturally, or they've become discouraged. And in the days of Paul, that might have been discouragement because of persecution of the church, or it might have been discouragement as they look around and Christians are dying, and they thought Jesus was going to come back before Christians died, and they're trying to sort this out, and they're like, well, why are so many Christians dying? We thought Jesus would be back by now. And so they're discouraged. So these are the timid. The weak are those who are weak spiritually. In the face of temptation or hardship, they crumble. In all three cases, the idle, the timid, and the weak, believers are not following through on their responsibility to live for Jesus. But in all three cases, the reason for their not following through is different. The idle are not weak or timid. The weak, they're not being idle. The timid are afraid, not weak. So look at what Paul says to do in each of these cases. He says, warn the idle, encourage the timid, help the weak. Paul's instructions match the different needs of people who are not living correctly. His instructions match their need. He doesn't say, help the idle. Right? If they're idle, if they can do it, they just don't want to, and you come along and do it for them, you're actually enabling their laziness. You know, I'm starting to kind of look ahead towards parenting teenagers. I don't have a teenager yet. But, you know, the idea that, you know, if you're constantly cleaning your teenager's room, well, they're not going to clean it on their own. Mom cleans it or dad cleans it. You're helping the idle. You're enabling them. He doesn't say, warn the timid. Hey, come on, you're afraid. Well, you better get going or bad things are going to happen. He says, no, encourage the timid. They're afraid. They don't need a warning. They need encouragement. They don't need a warning. They're already scared. They have the strength to do it. They don't have the courage to do it. So you encourage them. And he doesn't say, warn the weak. Hey, look, you better get on board with this or bad things are going to happen. No, they're weak. They're on board. They're trying. They just can't yet. Right? Encouraging the weak. Oh, you can do it. You can do it. Just try harder. That's actually infuriating. No, I can't. I'm too weak to do it. Sitting there saying, good job, isn't going to help. They're literally too weak to carry through. They don't need encouragement. They don't need a warning. They need help with the burdens that they can't carry. They may have the courage. They may have the desire. They don't have the strength. So you warn the lazy. You encourage the discouraged, the timid. You help the weak. Okay, that makes sense. How do I know which is which? From the outside, they may all look the same. How do I keep track? How do I know if you're lazy or intimidated? How do I know if you're lazy or just weak? How do we tell the difference? Because it really is significant. Well, we actually have to get to know one another. We actually have to enter into relationship. Knowing a person's needs only comes through relationship. Knowing a person's real need, do they need a warning? Do they need encouragement? Do they need help? Only comes through relationship with that person. It is only when we are in relationship with one another that we can discern if a person is idle or timid or weak and appropriately respond. The only way we know what kind of help to offer a person, real help, is who is struggling to be in relationship with Jesus, is for us to be in relationship with them. Now, we may judge from the outside thinking, well, I can read their actions. I can read their hearts through their actions. No, you can't. If you think back, you know, for the last couple years, we've talked a lot about that course, Emotionally Healthy Relationships, and the skills that it teaches. The second skill is to stop mind reading and clarify your expectations. Right? Jerry Scazzaro, she says, when I started doing this, it cut my sinning in half. Right? We take it upon ourselves to just warn everybody, or to just encourage everybody, or just help everybody. Well, we're mind reading. We haven't first determined if they're idle or timid or weak. And when you do that, you're more likely to do harm than good. Once we know a person's need, we are to apply the right remedy. Right? It's in the context of relationship that we can offer real tangible help. It's in the context of relationship, loving relationship, that we are effective tools of Jesus to bring rest to the weary, to bring a light yoke and an easy burden for people for whom life has gotten hard and the burden's too much. This is how we are used by the Spirit to bring new life to those for whom religion has become a grind and for whom being good has become a labor. And as we do it, we are to be patient with everyone, including or even especially when repeated attempts at help seem to be of little use or seem unwelcome. We are to be patient. So then how do we apply these texts, right? If this is how the church, one of the ways that the church can echo Jesus' invitation to the weary and the heavy laden to come unto Jesus through us that his burden is light, what do we do? So if Jesus says his burden is easy and his yoke is light, the church should be filled with people for whom the burdens of life are too much and they have come to Jesus for relief. The church should be a place for people where life is too much for me on my own. And so I'm here to find Jesus, and I find Jesus in all of you. He works through you in me. The church community should be a place in which people are finding abundant life and help with the burdens that are too much for them. That's actually what Paul says in another letter in Galatians chapter 6. He says we are to bear one another's burdens, burdens being that which no one person can carry, even as individuals, we are taking responsibility for our appropriate load that is our responsibility. So Paul is actually talking about that balance of, you know, don't enable people by doing for them what they can do for themselves, but help people with the burdens that are clearly too much for one person to carry. And that happens in community, and that should be happening in the community, the body of Jesus. So church should be a community where we find rest and help with our burdens. That should be what the church community is like. Jesus' invitation to the weak and weary is the invitation of the church, too, when the church is doing it appropriately and right. It is through the community of Christians that people come to Jesus, so his invitation should be our invitation, too. Do we create an atmosphere of safety, of appropriate concern, and relationship, and effective help for people for whom life has become a burden? Too often, we indulge the idle. We shame the timid, and we dismiss the weak. Too often, that is our natural human response, right? And we're not patient with any of them. Right? The people who are lazy, it's okay, well, you know, we can serve, and you just need, you serve when you're ready. Oh, you do that when you're ready. We shame the timid. Oh, really? You're afraid of that? Like, come on. You know, come on, why don't you do more? What's your problem? And the weak, they can't do anything. Right? But we're not to indulge the idle, we're to warn them. We're not to shame the timid, we're to encourage them. We're not to dismiss the weak, we're to help them. We don't respond with love to the weary and the heavy laden, by and large. We don't offer a light burden and an easy yoke. But when we're honest, we are all burdened. We are all broken in sin. We are all in need of rest for our souls. We all need encouragement to hold on to our hope. We all need help in our weakness to battle sin and temptation. So it's each of us, right? We need to be warned at times. We need to be encouraged at times. We need to be helped at times. Our calling as a church is to be a community of healing, rest, and support. That's what we're called to be. You maybe caught that quotation from Martin Luther talking about this passage in Matthew. He says, what Jesus is describing here, Jesus is saying, my kingdom is a hospital for invalids. We are to be a community that reflects Jesus' character, including his invitation to the weary, not only to provide rest, but to provide new equipment for the work of living life and carrying its burdens and its cares. And so then how do we answer the question, right? If that's pervasive, what we should be a community like for all people with all of their burdens, well, then that gives us light on how should we as individual Christians respond to the opioid crisis. Jesus' invitation to the weary and heavy laden is an invitation that extends to those who battle drug addiction too. Right? That's another burden of life that they are bearing. And in fact, they fit exactly into this invitation. Why? Because their drug addiction did not happen in a vacuum. Their addiction is a yoke they have taken upon themselves in an attempt to deal with life's burdens and weariness. Addiction, all addictive behavior, is an attempt to cope with difficult, unprocessed emotions. It is in our brokenness that we turn to behaviors that then become addictions as coping mechanisms. I don't just mean substance abuse, although that is certainly sometimes the easiest place to draw the straight line. Right? If you have a pain problem, you hear about like professional athletes who retire, they're in constant pain, and they were taking opioid-related pills when they were playing, and well, now they're still taking them, and they can't get off them. So sometimes that is like exact physical pain, straight line to pain relief, and there's an addictive habit there. Sometimes that's an example. But any addiction, it could be drinking, it could be gambling, it could be sexual addiction, it could be pornography, it could be adrenaline junkies, it could be a shopping addiction. These are all attempts to cope with life's difficult, unprocessed emotions. Have you ever heard somebody kind of joke and talk about, I need to go do some retail therapy? Right? I know somebody who recognizes in his own life, when things get hard, he starts hitting the thrift stores. And he's like, wow. You know, he'll have a difficult experience at work, and on the way home, he's at the Goodwill store, and he pulls in the parking lot, and he's like, wow, it's true. There is a direct line. So the thrill of the purchase, the thrill of the adrenaline rush, the thrill of winning can be so powerful and release powerful chemicals in our brain that are as powerful and more powerful than any drug you could buy on the street. And so these become addictive behaviors. Opioids and other drugs are a tool for dealing with pain, either physical or emotional. And like any tool, used appropriately, it's great. Used inappropriately, is bad. A hammer can be used to build a house or beat somebody up. So people who are dying from opioid overdoses are using the drugs to dull the pain. Now, maybe that's physical pain. More often than not, it's emotional pain. Right? They're trying to dull the pain of difficult, unprocessed emotions. And our job as Christians is not to condemn them for the attempt to deal with their pain inappropriately. Our job as Christians is to offer them a different hope to the hopeless, a meaning to the purposeless, worth to those who feel worthless, rest to the weary and the restless, healing to the broken, all through the power of the Holy Spirit in the name of Jesus. So when we see somebody who is battling addiction, I know my human response is to be like, dude, you got to get help. You know, you're getting what you deserve. Oh, you have a gambling addiction and you're broke. Big surprise. So easy for me to be judgmental. When instead, Christ living in me says, wow, you have an addiction problem. That means there's a huge wound. There's a deep wound in there somewhere, or maybe multiple wounds. And guess what? I found a person who's healing my wounds, and I'd like to introduce you to him. His name is Jesus. What a radically different response. And how disappointed I am in myself that that is not my normal response. Our response is to offer an invitation of love to the weary and burdened to find the yoke of Jesus. How do you respond to the opioid crisis as a Christian? To offer a love, an invitation of love to the weary and burdened. And if you want to see a weary and burdened group, people who are addicted to heroin or morphine is a weary, burdened group. Can we offer them an invitation to find a different yoke to deal with life's burdens? Our response to the opioid crisis, I believe, should be like the early Christians' response to the problem of leprosy. You know, it was the early Christians in the first, second century after Jesus who chose to see lepers as people created in the image of God and therefore worthy of love and respect. It was Christians who created leper colonies where they could live and be cared for and be fed and be housed and sheltered and treated with dignity, even as they were outcasts who had no help of healing beyond God's divine intervention. You know, in the Old Testament, there's a story of Naaman, the foreigner who came to Israel to be healed of leprosy. When he comes to the king of Israel, Israel's like, these people are trying to start a war. He's coming to me asking me to heal him of leprosy. Only God can heal leprosy. And then they send him to Elisha. In the ancient world, leprosy, healing of leprosy took divine intervention. And to be honest, when I look around today, and we look at the opioid crisis, and we look at the crisis of drug use, that takes a lot of divine intervention. But isn't it interesting that, you know, a number of times over the years, we've heard from people who come from Teen Challenge, which is the Christian-based residential recovery program for substance abuse. And isn't it interesting that the Christian-based recovery program has the highest success rate, like outstripping all of the secular programs? The last time they were here, one of the things they mentioned was that there were scholars and medical experts from Germany who had come to Teen Challenge here in Canada to see what they were doing because they were hoping to replicate something like that success rate in Germany. Because it is through the divine intervention of the love of Christ that we find our wounds healed, so that then fighting the drug addiction is about the chemical interaction, not about the emotional soothing and relief. So you may know somebody who uses drugs. We some of us do. You may not. You may never know somebody who is touched by the opioid crisis directly. You may. But as you hear it on the news, as you see it on the internet, as maybe you hear about it, chatted about at work, my prayer for you is my prayer for me, that as I hear about this moving forward, instead of my response being something along the lines of, well, you know, you're doing drugs, that's dumb, I hope your response will be the response I'm aiming for, which is, wow, there's a real brokenness and pain in this country, the only answer to which is Jesus. What am I going to do to help somebody else find Jesus so that in their pain and brokenness, they need not turn to substance abuse? Or if they have turned there, will I be the kind of person who's willing to touch a leper in order to show them the love of Christ? I'm praying that that will be my response moving forward, and I pray that that will be your response moving forward as well.